station, no troops down there to kill someone else's best friend. Ain't gonna fight no foreign wars. Don't even know what we're fighting for. Ain't gonna fight no wars no more. We should've learned that in the 60s. Can't justify no homemade fight. Our German, our philosophy's down their throats. Can't rationalize no secret wars. We should've learned that in the 60s. Why can't we spend our money on things don't have to do with bombs and guns? Why can't we send our food down there? Instead we gotta act like the 60s. Ain't gonna fight no foreign wars. Don't even know what we're fighting for. Ain't gonna fight no wars no more. We should've learned that in the 60s. In our efforts to show the world how democracy and freedom can work, we find ourselves bossing people around and advocating military of war. We find ourselves tied economically down. We ought to get our noses out of the fire so we don't get our fat nostrils burnt. We never ever learn from the 60s.
That was Marco Capelli with an SOA protest song sent to us here at WRPI via email, believe it or not, one of the listeners to Little Brother. So, let's get started. From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'm here tonight with, or this afternoon, with Phil Lil and Pete. Say hi, gang.
Hello.
And we will be your hosts for the next hour as we explore the world of the high tech. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. And you're listening to Little Brother. Topic is technology. And need to remind you before we get started that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for rebuttal. And I think as usual what we're going to do... Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, if you want to throw your opinion in, the phone number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. Please feel free to give us a call. And I think, as usual, we'll start with some items from the Risks Digest. This came from David Farber. He writes that homemade machines costing about $50 are being used to read credit card mag stripes without having to steal the cards. The information is then emailed abroad where cloned cards are fabricated. This has become a billion-dollar-a-year enterprise. The gadget was first demonstrated in maybe the 1960s at Caltech as part of a demo on how poor the magstripe credit cards were. In spite of that, they have been in use ever since then.
What about the smart cards? Can people duplicate those or get the information off of them?
I'm sure it's possible. I'm going to see if I can bring you guys up a bit here.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of this before, actually. They can do it with ATM cards, too. They can read the mag stripe and get your PIN right off it somehow. what they do is they have a thing that reads the mag stripe as you swipe it through and then keeps track of what you type in for a PIN.
Oh, yeah. Years ago, there was somebody had come out with come out and put up an ATM machine, a fake ATM machine.
Oh, they've more than one person's done it. Yeah. They used to do it in lots of little individual stores, you know, like your little convenience stores or your 7-Elevens.
This is interesting. We already have a caller on the line.
Wow. Is it for us?
I hope so. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
I think I must have the wrong number.
Okay,
oh,
never mind then.
Alrighty then.
Okay, well.
Well, I guess it's not for us.
No, it doesn't sound like it. That reminds me, I forgot to push this little button.
It was the wrong right number.
Something like that. There was actually a discussion on...
It was the wrong right number.
Something like that. There was actually a discussion on Slashdot recently that the discussion on Slashdot centered around the mag stripes on gift cards, and I had thrown in the suggestion that maybe they need to have a barcode as well as a mag stripe and have them cryptographically related so that if somebody comes in, the cash register makes the cashier both swipe the card and scan it. Because everybody's got those barcode scanners now, you know?
Sure, I got, know. You know, three at home, just sitting around.
Well, that's not quite what I meant, but you... you know
barcode
I mean.
Scanners are pretty interesting. It's like if you have a barcode scanner and you point it at, like, a Word document, it scans in what it finds right into the Word document or any kind of document. Just point it right at it. Those numbers show right up on your screen.
Yeah, right.
No, really.
Seriously?
Yep.
It just, yeah, when you scan...
It's like typing.
Yeah, when you scan a barcode, say the barcode represents like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, you mean a Word document that's got barcodes in it. Well, yeah, of course. Okay, yeah.
Or
yeah,
anything. I mean, you could just have a general purpose like document. You could even in Notepad.
Yeah, Notepad. It'll just come up with the numbers that are equivalent to that barcode.
Yeah, you have to but you have to have the barcode in front of you. I thought you were saying you were scanning a printed, you know, like these here.
Oh, no, document, yeah, no. You know? It's almost like the barcode scanners are like keyboards, except they're just optical. They,
Right. Yes, I have seen them done up that way. A company I used to work for had actually a customer that ordered a whole bunch of them up for, they were just using ordinary PCs for their point of sale business, for the point of sale terminals. Let's see. And speaking of the gift cards, many retailers are replacing paper gift certificates with small plastic cards containing magnetic stripes similar to on credit cards. Ideally, the purchase of a gift card would result in a database being updated to reflect the balance associated with the card's unique account number. Some retailers are using sequential account numbers and have no provisions to protect against a thief using a mag stripe reader or writer to reprogram a stolen card or small demonstration card or small denomination card, rather, so that it matches the account number of a larger valued card purchased by somebody else. Many retailers even provide a convenient 1-800 number so that the thief, knowing many valid account numbers, can shop for a card of significantly greater value. The risk, a form of fraud difficult to trace involving a minimal investment in equipment by the thief. Also note that the thief only requires the ability to query the back-end database, that is through the toll-free number, not the ability to manipulate the records. Perhaps more ominously, the risk is angry family members who find a zero balance on their gift cards. Solution.
Merry Christmas.
One retailer mentioned in an MSNBC article uses optical barcoding, which can't be re-encoded without defacing the card. Another follows a technique used by many credit card companies. Extra check digits are included in the mag stripe that aren't visible on the face of the card, and it seems astounding that these aren't being done by all of the above.
Here, honey, I bought you a depleted gift certificate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, what did I get? Can you at least tell me what I did get? Because I don't remember.
Tell me what I should have got.
Right. Maybe I'll find it somewhere.
And the thing that's startling, I know that some of the... from the discussion that took place on Slashdot, I know that a lot of these gift cards are really very, very incredibly low security. And some of them are actually quite excellent. there was one company, and I don't want to name it because I don't remember absolutely positively that this was the company it was, but was actually farming out their gift card business to American Express. So they had basically the whole mechanism behind American Express to back the thing. But a lot of them are doing it all in-house and apparently not doing it very well.
It might be one of those analyses where the IT department knows exactly how much the loss is going to be. Going, you know, like going with a cheap encryption version, and it's like not the loss of theft is less than the cost of putting that better encryption on. So it's like one of those calculated analysis where it's like it actually costs them less to do the cheaper card, even with the fraud going on.
Yeah, taking the educated risk.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, here's an item that was submitted by Clive Page to the Risks Digest. He says, although the UK is one of three European Union countries not to have adopted the euro, many large retailers in the UK announced that they would accept euros, but would give change in pounds sterling. Amongst these was the Debenhams chain of department stores. Incidentally, I'm told that officially the plurality of euro is euro, presumably to prevent language wars. Robert Shields, a 15-year-old Luton schoolboy, decided he would like the experience of using a euro, so he changed 10 pounds to euros at the bank, or to euro at the bank, and went on to his local branch of Debenhams to spend them. He found that they had programmed their tells as if they were 1.6 pounds to the euro, rather than 1.6 euros to the pound. But none of the sales assistants were experienced enough to notice the error, so after his initial purchase, he still had more than 10 pounds in change. He tried to tell the store staff that their mistake, but they said the rate was programmed into the computer, and nobody had the authority to change it. So, he carried on spending, and after 2 hours ended up with 130 pounds worth of goods and 20 pounds in cash. At this point, the store manager asked him to leave, saying, "I think you've had your fun." Richard then took a train to Bedford, about 20 miles away, to try his luck at another branch, but by this time the staff had been alerted and refused all euro transactions.
How to pay for your vacation. And have fun doing it.
You know, that would be a good that would be a good one for an, if they were to come out with an updated Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe, that would be a good one to throw in there.
Right.
That's almost as bad as the one I had a couple of weeks ago where a guy what was it? I think he was supposed to sell 16 shares of a stock at 610,000 yen apiece, and he reversed the order to sell 610,000. Yeah, I see the look on your face, Pete. Folks, let me tell you, I wish I had my camera right now because the look on Pete's face is a true photographic moment of the vendor
horror
of your choice.
Of absolute horror.
Absolute abject horror. But yes, that somebody sold 610,000 shares of a stock for 16 yen when they meant to do just the opposite.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, somebody's fired over that one.
I'm sure of it.
I wonder what ritual they have for that activity.
I believe it's called Harakiri. Anyway.
Certain type of it.
I don't know.
When other people do it to you.
Oh, he just got it.
Otto Stoltz submitted to the Risks Digest. He says, here's one more example of the unexpected implications of a large project, such as the introduction of a new currency. It's not a murderous risk, but you may find the story instructive and perhaps amusing. Today, he says, I received an assessment from the local tax office. The amount due was the former amount converted from Deutschmarks to Euro, almost, but not exactly. You see, it was rounded up to the nearest multiple of 10 cents. Thus, the new annual amount was no more a multiple of 4. As the amount is due by quarterly installments, the assessment told me to pay 3 equal amounts at certain dates every year, and another amount, which was 2 cents larger, at some later date. Of course, my bank had already converted my standing remittance order from Deutschmarks to Euro. However, this not being adequate, I tried to adapt it to the new tax assessment. I dare not risk the trouble of owing anything to the tax office, not even for 2 cents, would you? I guess their tax office in Germany is as ominous as the IRS is. It turned out that the bank is not prepared to handle a standing order of this type. I could have 4 annual orders instead, 1 per quarter. I preferred to do it the other way. I left my original order as it was and placed a new order for 2 cents, roughly 2 cents US, per year. I hope well that somebody at the tax office will be irritated with this extra payment. The lesson to be learned, any change in a large working system will have unexpected, possibly undesired results. Be on your guard.
I heard of some story before where DMV sent a bill to someone for a dollar and they sent a check for $1.01 and it really screwed them up.
I've heard of people doing things like that. I did, at one point in time, work a very short stint in a receiving office where they were taking in payments on loans. And one of the things that was used in the case that there was no account number or the account number was illegible or wrong or something like that, well, then we'd try to look the person up by name and address, and if all else failed, we'd try to match it up by the dollar amount. And so somebody could write a starter check for 2 cents off with a completely bogus account number written on it and really throw the whole works into a tizzy. And I can understand why they'd get worked up about it, but it's amusing nonetheless. Mm-hmm. You know?
Besides, you know, we want to make sure that they're really working for our money that we're sending them.
Yeah, exactly.
We want to get the most bang for our buck.
Right.
Or
this
penny.
Is a test.
This is a test of the efficiency of your office.
Oh, boy.
Right, what's the memo say? This is a test of your efficiency.
Oh, here's an interesting one. This was submitted by NewsScan, and they said the web surfing habits of people who used the LimeWire, Grokster, and Kazaa music sharing programs were surreptitiously tracked because those programs were linked to an online sweepstakes called Click Till You Win, in which players pick numbers and win cash prizes. The company that operates the sweepstakes game says it told outside distributors to get users' permission before installing the software, but in these cases, their action was not taken. The three companies have posted new versions of their software without the tracking component, and LimeWire has issued an apology. You're not still using an outdated version of LimeWire, are you?
Yeah, I'm using LimeWire 1.6, which is really old.
Yeah, it is.
And as far as I know, I've searched, and there's no issues regarding the older version.
Sometimes the older versions are better, you know?
Yeah, that's why I still stick with it.
Okay, well, you've at least got Zone Alarm, so you're watching.
But in Zone Alarm, you're allowing LimeWire to pass, so it could pretty much do anything it wants, and it's going to get through.
Yeah, but isn't this going to show up as some other application? I don't know.
It could. I mean, if it's running, if it's not running within LimeWire and it's running as a separate app, like triggered by LimeWire.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
What does it run as, a Java applet?
LimeWire?
Yeah, no, the advertising software that's associated with it.
It doesn't really say. I kind of got the impression that it was a. I'd kind of gotten the impression that it was a an executable.
Well, I know
it was compiled into the code.
Yeah. There's a piece of spyware out there called Sidor, which is bundled with Kazaa, which is a popular music transfer program. And if you remove if you remove Sidor, Kazaa no longer works anymore.
So oh, yeah, I remember that one.
They force you to keep the spyware on your system if you want to use the service.
Yeah, basically, if the code is compiled in there, it's running as mm-hmm. the executable. So there's no way that you can separate them. Mm-hmm. You'd have to basically analyze the code and then write a loop around that piece. And then if they were looking for any kind of feedback, you'd just have to fake it. Like, yeah, we did what you said we were going to do.
Mm-hmm. Or something like that, yeah. Well, let's see what else we got here. Over the hiatus, we actually got three different issues of the Risks Digest arrived. So I haven't, unfortunately, had time to give them all the... all the attention that they needed to figure out what we're going with here. But here's one about losing control of a satellite. This was an unharmonic convergence of a solar eclipse and a satellite's invisible orbit. That's put in quotes. That's, I guess, a navigational term for satellite work. On December 14th, 2001, the Japanese solar observatory Yoko began spinning out of control. Since then, all scientific operations have stopped, and it remains unclear when the craft will be operational again. The problem began during last month's annual eclipse of the sun. Yoko uses a sun-centering system to determine its position at any given time. During the eclipse, the craft lost contact with the sun, put itself into safe mode, and slowly began to drift off track and rotate. Normally, this wouldn't have been a problem, during its decade in orbit, Yoko has seen its share of eclipses. However, this event occurred during a rare period of the craft's orbit, known as the invisible orbit, when the craft was out of communication with the Earth. Thus, controllers on the ground couldn't detect or compensate for the craft's sudden roll. The problems only got worse from there. Because of its slow roll, Yoko's solar panels no longer received direct sunlight, and by the time ground controllers at the Kagoshima Space Center regained contact with the observatory, its batteries were very low and the craft had lost attitude control. Needs a new attitude.
Yono lost attitude control. Yoko, sorry. Yoko. Yono is a restaurant.
So could
Yoko
it could flip-flop between good and bad attitude. Just at will, randomly.
To fix the problem, scientists first established...
There are so many jokes in this somewhere.
I know.
If
there?
I just knew more about John Lennon, there are so many jokes in this somewhere.
I'm sure. To fix the problem, scientists first established contact and turned off all the craft's science instruments in order to conserve power. Currently, the craft is rotating slowly, about one rotation per minute. According to Lauren Acton, Montana State University, head scientist of Yoko's solar X-ray telescope, in the spacecraft's current state, its solar panels only receive sunlight in spurts. During flashes of illumination, electricity is produced, says Acton. Thus, the first step towards recovery is for scientists to wait until the craft can charge up. It's currently unclear when and even if scientists will regain control of the craft, but astronomers are hopeful. It'll take clever work to stop the roll and reacquire the sun.
Oh, it's 10 years old. It's about ready to replace it anyway.
Well, I mean, that I know that's the common wisdom when it comes to consumer-grade electronics,
but this is
seriously industrial-strength stuff, and these are expensive things to put up.
Right, well, most satellites, I mean, you're out there and in the harsh environment of space, and, you know, rechargeable batteries don't typically last more than 10 years anyway.
Oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're getting at. Although you can make rechargeable batteries last better if you take proper care of them, and I suspect they probably put the best charger that their engineers could design in these things. At least I know I would if I was trying to put something up there for the long haul.
You know there's a myth about rechargeable batteries. When something happened, but way back when on a satellite where when the rechargeable batteries first came out, the spacecraft would charge up only, it was like exactly the same amount every day, or it was so close, the battery only went between like, you know, 10 and 12% of its capacity, and it built this chemical lit barrier so that when they tried to do something like move it out of its orbit or do something different that required more,
it ran out of power.
It ran out of power because it hit this chemical barrier and it couldn't get power. So everybody was like, you know, it's big news, like these things don't work right, you know, you always have to discharge your batteries fully in order to get...
That's,
you know, condition them.
The memory effect.
The memory effect, right.
It's like a crystallization that forms, but you can't zap that with a burst of low current, high voltage.
Yeah, but if you're not set up to do that out there, then you can't, it's not, you know, that option isn't available. But people were, you know, for a while it was like, you know, a negative effect on the marketing of these rechargeable batteries because like, oh, they have memory effect. Well, yeah, if you charge them up exactly the same amount every day for like 2 years.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I know that in cases where you have a renewable energy system where you're using solar power during the day to charge up your batteries to run through the night for a domestic application, frequently you'll have some means at your disposal to do what's called, this is if your system was installed correctly, you'll have a means in the system to execute what's called a equalization charge, and it's basically the same idea: get the memory out of the battery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teach it to forget once in a while.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because like, you can just imagine this like chemical barrier that just doesn't allow anything to happen past it, just forming in your battery. It's like Casper the Unfriendly Ghost.
I know. I'm probably going to have to deal with it at some point myself. I have this very regimented habit with my ham radio, which will probably come back and get me maybe a year down the road. So I understand. Let's see here. What else have we got going on here? Oh, yeah. Oh, this is cute. William Colburn writes this one. He says, when I go to McAfee Virus Alerts webpage, I read the somewhat disconcerting line, this page current as of, and it ends without even a period. Now, what am I to assume about the currentness of the page? Turning on JavaScript gives me a slightly different answer that reads, this page current as of Monday, January 4th, 1971. Okay. So now I know that as of early January 1971, there are no virus alerts for any 1980s era DOS boxes and 1990s or 2000s era Windows boxes. That sure makes me feel a whole lot better. Not only are there no virus alerts, but the machines those alerts would have been for hadn't been invented yet. Oh, wait. The clock on my machine is just wrong. The web page merely printed out the local concept of the day and year. Now, how much can I trust that page now? The concept of current is local to me, the reader, via JavaScript. I don't need to go out onto the internet to download a current copy of the page from McAfee and website to get up-to-date version. I just have to reload my locally cached copy, and presto, it has today's date on it. And I'll never again have to worry about virus alerts because there won't be any. The risk here is that somebody... the risk here is that somebody could look at this web page, see an invalid date because their machine has the wrong time or because the web page was cached somewhere and not re-downloaded. This result would be that somebody might not find out about an important high-risk virus that could potentially do a lot of damage. P.S. I complained about this to McAfee using their online form about a month ago and haven't heard anything back.
Wow, that'd be a great way to still get into somebody's computer, even though they had all the protection that they thought they needed.
Yeah, it's just exactly.
Their clock was wrong. Wow. Does it really matter what time it is if there's a virus out there? Don't you need the virus?
Well, no, it doesn't really matter what the time is, but the thing of it is you need to know if you have a current version of your virus squasher so you know that it will handle the current versions of the virus that are out there.
I just manually update the DAT files every week. I'll check for an update and just do it myself.
Yeah, that's the thing to do, but I mean, a lot of people just...
Yeah, don't trust the automatic updates.
No. No, really.
We're still back to the point of no matter how up-to-date you are, there's always going to be that new virus that doesn't have a definition yet, so it's like as if you don't have virus software.
Right.
Right, exactly.
They catch on pretty quick, though. I mean, they'll update it within a day or two. But, yeah, still, there's always the risk.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to, move on to the final risks digest that I have here. This one, who submitted this? This was submitted by Paul van Keep from the Netherlands. He says, there was a veritable plethora of Euro-related gaffes just before the final changeover. A short overview of what has happened. A housing society in Eindhoven has sent out bills for next month's rent in Euro. But the amount on it is the same as last month's rent, which was in guilders. That's a 2.2 times increase. Society has declared that anybody who paid the incorrect amount will be fully refunded and will get a corrected bill later. A branch of the ING Bank in Blerick inadvertently inserted the wrong cassette into an ATM, which began to give out euro bills instead of guilders. This was illegal before January 1st, 2002. The bank has traced the bills and all but 10 euro have allegedly been returned. Rabobank has... That's a heck of a name for a bank.
I've actually seen one.
Rabobank has made an error in its daily processing of 300,000 automatic transfers. Instead of transferring guilders, the transfers were made in euro. Again, 2.2 times what should have been transferred. The bank hopes to have corrected the mistake before 6 p.m. On December 28th. Let's see here. Yeah, it said 6 p.m. tonight, so I had to go back and look at what the date was on that. Due to the euro changeover, no banking activity will take place in any of the euro countries on Monday. That would have been January 1st. And just somewhat related, two companies thought they were being really smart by putting euro bills in Christmas gifts for their employees. They have been ordered by the Dutch Central Bank to recover all of those bills or face charges. The euro troubles keep coming in. Even though banks have had 4 to 5 years to prepare for the introduction of the euro, things still go wrong. This is an update also from Paul van Keep. This was on the 3rd. He said, on the 2nd and 1st, and I lost my place. Yeah, on the 2nd and 1st, over 200 smaller Dutch post offices have had to remain closed because of computer problems relating to the euro changeover. It's still unclear whether the situation will finally be resolved by the next day. Let's see. About 51,000 customers who withdrew money from their ING bank account on the 1st and 2nd of January 2002 through an ATM have had the wrong amount debited from their account. The bank hasn't yet given an explanation for the error other than to suspect that it was related to the high stress their systems were under during the first few days of the new year. The amounts debited from customer accounts were 100 times what they withdrew from the ATMs. This got some people into trouble when their balance went negative and they could no longer use their bank PIN card to pay within shops. ING Bank corrected the error on the 4th of January.
See, this is one of those occasions where, you know, you have stuff set up ahead of time, you know, just as a consumer. I mean, I would have had all my money out of the bank, you know, my shelves stocked with food and whatnot. And maybe that's just me, you know. It doesn't take that much effort.
Paul continues to say that on a related note, his wife withdrew euro from an ATM and the printed receipt came up blank. The guess is that the ink ribbon on the embedded matrix printer ran out. Bank personnel are working like crazy to feed the machines with euro bills and simply forget to check the printer. If the bank makes a mistake similar to the one that ING made, she would have a hard time proving that she didn't actually withdraw 10,000 euro. Ben Rosengart further adds about the euros that the European Central Bank is working with technology partners on a hush-hush project to embed radio frequency identification tags into the very fibers of euro banknotes by 2005. Intended to foil counterfeiters, the project is developing as Europe prepares for a massive changeover to the euro and would create an instant mass market for RFID chips, which have long sought profitable application. I hardly know where to begin, even thinking about the risks involved.
That is pretty amazing. I mean, because right now that Europe is much further ahead than we are in smart card technology. I mean, their deployment of it is like state of the art.
Going to have to ask you to hold that thought for a minute because we need to take a break for a station ID and to get some paperwork done here in the studio. Stay tuned. Little Brother will return.
You certainly don't want to listen to anyone preach to you about quitting smoking. Nicotine in your blood.
You're listening to 91.5 FM, WRPI, Troy.
I won't have any more. Nicotine overdose. How about doing something physical? Everyone will understand. Nicotine on your hands could get into your eyes and nose and could cause stinging, redness, or irritation problems. Hey, one's not gonna kill me. Your senses of smell and taste may improve. Have a mint. Cope with temptations to smoke. You'll be able to enjoy life without relying on a cigarette. This isn't the time for you to use the patch.
And you're listening to 91.5 FM at WRPI in Troy, New York. The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. That tune there was put together by Phil. And interesting bass on that one.
And Lil is sick of it already.
Well, yeah, I can kind of understand that. I mean, when you're putting something together, you kind of do it over and over and over. And
oh, yeah, there's been a lot of revisions before I finally got that copy.
That's but, something near and dear to you, right?
No, it's fun to do. I'm not a musician. I just do it for the hell of it. Yeah,
educational purposes.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean, but I understand that you are trying to quit, and good for you.
Yes, I have been wearing the patch for 6 days now.
Yeah, and you get the free little CD with it.
Yeah,
advice on
it's a free CD, and it's just this guy droning on and on about how wonderful it is to quit. And I just thought it'd be really funny to take clips from that and just make it into a song. So.
That's pretty cool.
And who knows, if you can convince other people that you're quitting, maybe you can convince yourself that you're quitting too.
I'm still freaking out a little bit. I'm all jittery.
Well, let's see if we can pick up where we left off here. Pete, looks like you were taking notes as usual.
Well,
talking about the RFID chips in the Euro notes.
Right.
Tell me what's on your mind.
Well, I mean, it's really great. I mean, that they're talking about things like that, but you know, it just proves another point. Is like, what are we doing over here? First of all, they're so far ahead in the technology, like smart cards, and the deployment of it. And now they're looking at even more safe technology, or consumer centric, and. Looking at ways to stop thievery and things like that. But, I don't hear anything about, we're still using the same old dumb dollar bill. And, there's no real strong deployment of smart cards, although you can start getting them. That American Express Blue Card is along that lines.
Now, what about the reverse side of it, where, as the consumer, we're concerned about our privacy?
Oh yeah, right. Where each dollar that you have is a unique one, so that people
right.
Yeah.
So when we go into like another world and buy some crazy like latex outfit or whatever, everybody knows.
right. So then the marketing study will go back.
Yeah, they know how much I've spent at Russ and Rebel Leather or something. I don't like that.
Put up a shop closer to Lil's house. it'll be actually more convenient for you to purchase those latex. Outfits.
Yeah, but with all the smart card technology, it's still not going to help you if, say, you phone in an order, like a mail order.
No, not at all.
No, but then it's still tracked because of your credit card number that you ordered it with, or your check number.
I'm not talking about privacy, I'm talking about security. Like, if someone stole your smart card, if a store is equipped with the technology to not allow you to use it, you could still call a place and have something shipped to another address.
It is a really good point, though. There's like definitely pros and cons to having that kind of protection. Mm-hmm. It's like, just because they put it in there, you're right, doesn't mean that it's a good thing. It's going to stop certain kind of crimes, and probably it'll cause more. Like you said, I mean, how many times does somebody counterfeit a euro? As opposed to how many times does somebody sell your information when you bought something from a store to somebody else who wants to get in your pocket too?
Well, I'm sure that euro counterfeiting has already happened at this point. I mean, jeepers, they've had 3 weeks to work on it.
Is that the idea? Is like of having the RF chip in there is just to stop counterfeiting, or is it really?
Well, that's the given explanation. Yeah, of course, it certainly would serve that purpose.
So in other words, if there's like basically these RF microcircuits work is when you pass, they don't have any energy in them, but when you pass by a detector, the detector puts out microwaves, which activates it.
There's going to be microwaves coming out of my wallet?
No.
I don't like that.
When you pass in front of a detector, the microwaves just flood everywhere, and those microwaves activate the RF chip, which then stores enough of that energy, and then once it has enough, it emits a burst of its own radio frequency that says, "Here I am, this is my number."
Well, I know that I know that actually the RFID chips don't usually work on microwave frequencies. Quite the opposite, actually. They usually work on very low frequency. But do you see what I'm holding in my hand here? It might be a little hard through the window there. What you see in my hand here, and I'll describe it for the listeners, it's a credit card-sized device. It's about maybe twice the thickness of a credit card. It probably with today's technology could be made thinner. This is about 10 years old. But this device, which has no barcode, no magnetic stripe, or anything else that is really obviously readable, is the key that I use to get into my office. All I have to do is hold it near a detector and get it maybe within 6 inches, and the thing goes beep and the door opens. And this is the same technology we're talking about. Now, the question that would come to my mind with these RFID chips being implanted in Euro bills, this card that I'm holding has got a range of 6 inches. What's the range on the Euro bills going to be? Am I going to be able to walk by somebody on the street with the appropriate device and know how much cash he's carrying?
I think so. I mean, I do. I think so. If the smaller they are, the higher the frequency, though, because that what you're holding that probably has an antenna in it, and that's why it's able to operate at a lower frequency, because it has a bigger antenna to collect the longer wavelength.
Yeah, but do you know how big an antenna for 250 kilohertz is?
No.
Huge.
Like 6
absolutely
meters.
No, more keep guessing higher.
I have to do my inverse calculation on the
600 meters would be closer to the mark.
Wow. But anyway, so there's a value of RF energy that they use that specifically works with whatever. The smaller the chip is, the higher the frequency, because the less capture mechanism that chip has. So
right.
Some of these things, they look like almost like Band-Aids. There's a strip of tape that sticks, you know what I mean? Then there's a little area where the chip is underneath that, and then you slap them on whatever unit you're trying to track. Like, if I wanted to track you, I'd just slap one on your back. It would say, kick me. But
I don't know.
Kick me, I'm number 724774.
And here's the other thing, too. I think that these RFID chips are actually getting quite cheap, because only a few years ago there were a series of toys that came out from that were action figures from the Star Wars Episode I movie. Do you remember those?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. You had a device that looked like the communicator that they were using, and you put the action figure down on top of the communicator, and it would use an RFID tag to read a recording out of the action figure and play it for you. You know? So,
yeah.
Like I say, obviously these things are getting dirt cheap.
Yeah.
I don't know about frequency of operation. I presume that, obviously, you know, I understand radio. I understand what you're saying about the higher frequency being perhaps better with such a short antenna as you're likely to have on this. And I just don't know. It's just the idea of money that can talk back without my knowledge is kind of scary.
That is amazing. And how far along are they with this?
Like I said, they're planning to put them in by 2005.
I mean, how many dollar bills probably already have them in there that you don't know about?
The euros, you mean?
I mean, if they're talking about doing it now, then you know that somebody's done it just as a trial basis, you know?
I'll have to...
Chuck, come here. I got some euros for you.
I'll have to hold a couple of dollar bills up to the...
That's not telling me where you go every day.
I'll have to hold a couple dollar bills up to the reader at work and see what happens.
Well, they already have some kind of identification strips of some type in the higher bills, at least.
Yeah, I know the strip you're talking about. I'm not sure if that's... I don't think that's RFID, though.
I think it's magnetic.
Yeah, exactly. And dollar bills were magnetic to begin with anyway. The ink that the serial number is printed on with is magnetic ink. But, I mean, that's...
Can you encode a dollar bill?
No. It's using magnetic coding. I know it sounds like off the bat I'm saying it's the same thing as a credit card, but it's not. To read the number off a dollar bill or off of a check, you know, those numbers that appear on the bottom of a check, you have to go through, the reader will actually magnetize it and then read it back. And it uses the pattern of different layers and kind of gets a rough picture of it, and then just applies OCR techniques to it. They call it MICR. It's magnetic ink character reader.
So if it's actually reading it off the magnetic ink, what's the point in the little strip that they put in it?
What do you mean?
The little actual plastic strip.
You got a fiver or a 10 or a 20?
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, take it out, hold it up to the light, and near one end you'll see there's a black strip that's about an inch in from one end. You see it? And it should say, what do you got there, a 20?
Yeah.
Yeah, it should say, you'll see...
Oh, yeah, that's a new bill. It should definitely have it. Sometimes people rip them out, though.
P, here's a 10. I'll trade you.
Yours has more written on it. It's probably better.
Oh, no, mine's not an inch. I've got a 10. It's almost in the middle.
Okay.
Not an inch from the end.
You see it?
Yep.
Yeah.
And
that's right embedded in the fiber.
But USA 10, USA 10.
Which one of these is not like
that? That's magnetic ink right there.
I'm not sure if it's magnetic ink or not, but you see the serial number printed on it?
Mm-hmm.
That is.
Well, the serial number's not printed on the actual strip, though. What purpose does the strip serve? That's what I want to know.
Exactly. I'll have to find out and get back to you, I guess.
Yeah, we'll have to find out.
There's a lot of little tiny microtext around Hamilton's head, too. Like around the oval.
Yeah, that's for
there's a whole bunch of stuff on there.
There's all kinds of, you know, it's offset from the center, so it's more difficult to reproduce, and there's lots of things on it that are...
Layer after layer after layer after layer of this stuff. Well, let's see what else we have here. Actually, I'm going to drop the Risks Digest for a minute here. And pick up another item. Phil brought this in. This came out of the Schenectady Gazette. You've heard me talk before about copy-protected CDs. This is written by Michael Stroh of the Baltimore Sun. He says, last month, Eric Fredericks unwrapped a copy of More Fast and Furious, a new soundtrack from the movie The Fast and the Furious, popped the CD into his boombox, and this is what he heard. Absolutely nothing.
He didn't even hear someone laughing at him. He didn't even hear four people laughing at him.
Silence. The disc, he said, just spun and spun and spun. Nor did he hear anything in his Sony PlayStation 2, one of the video game consoles that doubles as a CD player. Ditto for his two home computers, on which Fredericks, a 29-year-old furniture store manager in Acworth, Georgia, prefers to listen to his music collection. The sound of silence is a nuisance music lovers might hear more and more often as the record industry, in its battle against digital bootlegging, takes the fight to the home front, your CD collection.
Don't they use that for some kind of like some kind of Buddhist meditation? What is the sound of silence? And now you'll be able to say The Fast and the Furious.
Given that I am not a Buddhist, I don't know. Sorry, what?
The CD might have worked if you put it on like a record player.
Well, he would have gotten some sound out of it.
Playing a CD on a CD player, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, it was released last month by Universal Music Group, and it's the first copy-protected CD from a major label. Like an electronic combination lock, the technology allows companies to control how and where the consumers can play their tunes. Well, you know, they've been saying right along that what they're trying to do is keep it from being read on computers, and supposedly they put a WMA copy of it on there, but of course that leaves Mac users and Linux users out in the cold. Obviously it doesn't play on a PlayStation. I guess it's a no PlayStation. But I had read also during the past week that Philips has spoken out on this topic. Philips, just by point of authority, Philips is the designer of the compact disc digital audio standard that has been the standard for the past, oh, how long have they been around? I guess they've been around 15, 20, maybe even 25 years. I guess the mid-80s is when they came out. Yeah. Philips has declared that these CDs that have the Cactus data protection system on them may not bear the Compact Disc Digital Audio logo.
That makes sense, because that would be like very negative publicity when you have a when you buy a compact disc that doesn't work. You're like, well, I guess Philips didn't do a very good job making these.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Maybe the Philips standard isn't that great.
Maybe we need a new standard.
Well, the thing of it is, I think that a lot of people are not aware to look for these little logos because we've just gotten so used to them. But yes, there is a logo that will appear on the front of your CD player, and it'll appear on your on most any CD in your CD collection. There may be one or two in there that got skipped, but for the most part, they should have this logo on it. It's very straightforward. It's got the word disc in very large lowercase letters. Compact fit in above it, and underneath it says just plain digital audio. Likewise, there's a similar logo for videotapes. If you look at any one of them, they've got a particular font and a particular framing for the VHS that appears on the videotape. And if you want to go back a little bit to some technology that's pretty much out of the loop at this point, you would see the same thing on beta tapes. There's a very, very specific logo. And somebody owns those logos and licenses them. And every once in a while, you'll get one of these really cheap, chintzy tapes. You know that it's not quite right. Usually it's made out of very soft plastic, the cartridge is. And if you look all over the thing, you will not see the logo on it saying VHS. Because officially, it's not. Officially, if that tape damages your VHS video player, no recourse. You know, you put something in there that wasn't a VHS tape. In this particular case, I'd say it's very unlikely that one of these discs would actually damage your CD player.
No, but they'll sure be a nuisance.
Absolutely.
You know, for those of us that are used to being able to, you know, maybe at work, just pop a CD into your computer and listen to it, suddenly we can't listen to some CD.
And I think that the appropriate reaction is that we as the consumers need to push back. If you happen to land yourself one of these CDs, you should probably take it and your portable CD player back to the store and demonstrate for them that it doesn't function. Of course, the record store, all they're going to be able to do is give you a replacement of the CD because of the fact that if they give you a store credit, you could go buy a disc, bring it home, copy it, bring it back, trade it, bring it home, copy it, bring it back, trade it, copy it. You know, you get the picture.
So they
won't let you have another disc. They'll only let you have another copy of the same.
Okay,
After enough iterations of this, the stores are going to start to get ticked off. You know?
Yeah, one thing I've done before is I bought a CD, and because they don't let you preview the songs before you buy it. Say the CD really, you know, I didn't like it. And I brought it back to the store. They gave me another exact copy, still shrink-wrapped and sealed, and then they brought it back to another store in a different mall, you know, the same store but in a different mall, and I'm like, hey, you know, I got this as a gift, here's the receipt, still shrink-wrapped, and I just traded it for another one.
Yeah.
So what
do we look for? Is there an emblem for the encrypted disc?
No, I wouldn't think so, but I would just look to see if you can find the emblem for the regular disc.
So the other one won't be there if it's an encrypted audio disc?
Not if Philips has their way about it. I think Philips is going to be moving to protect that logo.
Maybe because Philips isn't getting any royalties from this new encryption technology. That's why they're like...
You know, that's an interesting way of looking at it, and you may be right there. I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't actually own any device anymore that is just a CD player.
I own one. That's it. I never use it. It's still at my mother-in-law's house from my wedding in August.
I mean, I
never ever use it. I just use computers.
Yeah, exactly. I use my computer to play them. Actually, usually the first thing I do with a CD when I get it is I add it to my MP3 collection, and then I park the CD on a shelf.
Yeah.
And the reason I do that is because of the fact that I can put my MP3 collection on shuffle, and it's a lot cheaper than going out and buying one of these 100 disc changers that's going to randomly pick songs that you don't like.
Well, after the show, on the way back home, why don't we all pop into the mall and buy ourselves a copy of The Fast and the Furious so that next week, on our way to the show, we can return it complaining about how we can't play it.
There you go.
And then you know, get the switch over that we so richly deserve and do the same thing next week.
But I mean, like, really what they're doing is they're kind of forcing people to put it on a player and then make a copy that they can play somewhere.
Well,
it's like they're pushing people into like the act of creating a duplicate that is playable on.
But I can't play it on my computer.
But you can bring it over to a friend's house, play it, make an audio recording, and then an MP3 out of it. And they're forcing you to do exactly what they don't want you to do.
I can't play it on my computer. It probably won't play in my portable MP3 player. It won't play probably on my DVD player. Won't play. That's all the devices I got. Never mind.
So what does it play on? What does it play on?
A perfectly ordinary plain vanilla CD player only. Or a Windows computer.
A Windows computer, okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So where's the association there?
What makes it work on Windows?
Yeah.
They put in a very, very, from what I understand, pitiful piece of player software right on the disk.
Oh. That works with Windows.
Yep.
I wonder
if Linux, like I said, Linux users are out in the cold. Mac users are out in the cold.
So you have to load this little program from the disk in order to play this?
Uh-huh.
Or have a really, like, most car stereos are just regular CD players, aren't they?
Yes, actually. Although, I know of at least one person who's got a CD-based MP3 player in his car.
Okay.
And these things are starting to pop up like crazy.
So now when you have a smart CD player, it finds that first executable code, and then it doesn't really know what to do with it?
Not a smart CD player. It just doesn't know how to read the CD. Only the real CD player, only the basic one, the dumb one, is able to do it. I know, it's pretty lame, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Every once in a while, I'll be astonished at how many CD players are around me. Like, when I walk into my house, I have, you know, like every once in a while, like once a month, I'll be like, you know, I think there's 12 CD players in this house. You know, there's 6 computers with a CD. I have like a CD changer, an alarm clock CD. The DVD will play a CD.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's like 12 different ways I could play a CD.
Exactly.
Not anymore.
I want to get one of these discs just to find out which ones they play in.
All right. Well, we're up against the clock here, so I'm going to have to bring this to a close. Faisal Ahmed is here to do a window on Islam, and he'll be up next. So stay tuned here to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy, and we'll see you later.
And now, I am ready.
Won't you come see me now, my love? Are you thinking of me and how easy it could be? Won't you come over to me now? We can be together. Will you?